Now, you've been at sea for months.
The men are sick, and they're about to starve.
Water is scarce, and your only hope is that God will make land appear. And appear it did. A place that valued knowledge over gold, civility over barbarism, and Christianity above all other religions. Let's go visit Bacon's New Atlantis. Maybe you got lost somewhere, swimming too far off the beach, off the coast. Woo, let's get this show on the road. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Cause. My name is Rob, and today we got an exciting one for you. We're going to be discussing the second book in the third volume of the Harvard Classic series, The New Atlantis, by Francis Bacon. It's a very unique story, I think, at least in the time frame in which it was written. The New Atlantis was actually published a year after Bacon died by Dr. Raleigh, and the work is actually unfinished, and it ends rather early in what I believe could have been a fairly long story. I would go as far as to say the book only has an introduction, as the book is still kind of being set up with those introductory details whenever it ends. It's very obvious by the book what kind of world Bacon desired to live in, and also what he wanted removed from society. Let's run through a quick synopsis of the story real quick, and then we'll follow it up with some takeaways and like the meaning of the New Atlantis. The book starts off setting a dismal scene. There's a Spanish ship sailing from Peru to China and Japan, and I only say Spanish because that's the language they refer to speaking in the book. The ship hit some unfavorable wind conditions, and the crew finds themselves in the greatest wilderness of waters in the world, the Pacific Ocean. Now, the crew in the story is never, like, named individually, but it appears to me that the author includes himself, kind of, as one of the characters. Land eventually appears, and they stumble upon a strange civilization. The people of Ben Salem. Initially, the people tell him, you know, don't come ashore. Don't land here. None of that. Keep your boat out there. But they also said, you know, give us some details of what you need. If you need food or if you need some medicine or something like that. And they would provide for it. And what's weird is the civilization had knowledge of Hebrew, Greek, Latin, and the Spanish languages. And judging by the symbology that they wore and stuff like that, it kind of appeared that they were a Christian people. And at this point, the reader's kind of left wondering, how did they become Christians? And how do they know the languages of Europe? A member of the society finally offers to bring them on land. And we will dive more into the society and that organization in just a bit. But this individual sets them up with, you know, rather nice accommodations. This member gives them rooms for the sick. He gives them rooms for everybody else to kind of rest in. And they also provide them what appears to be some bomb food, drinks, and libations. Now, the crew members are kind of unsure. They're untrusting. They kind of don't really know what's going on right now. This is a weird scene. They were about to give up hope on a stranded ship, and now they're being treated like royalty. The governor of the House of Strangers, basically just the place they're staying at, he meets with them, and he offers them to stay for 6 weeks. He also allows them to ask some questions. And naturally, they are curious about how people on the other side of the world became Christians. So they ask, who was the apostle of that nation, and how was it converted to the faith? So the governor basically explains the story. He said about 20 years after the crucifixion of Christ, that a pillar of light showed up about a mile off the coast of Ben Salem. The people of Ben Salem start to venture out towards that pillar of light to see what it is about. Once they get too close, though, their boats become bound and they can't move any closer to this pillar of light. One of the more respected individuals eventually prays to God in what appears to be like a God-ordained prayer, because a lot of the stuff that he's praying about, he would not have known unless it was provided by God. This man alone is eventually unbound, so to speak, and he starts moving closer to the pillar. The pillar of light at this point breaks up into particles and it disperses, and a small cedar arc is left hovering on the water. And I love the symbology here, because you have Noah's Ark, which carried Noah, and then you have the Ark of the Covenant of God, which carried the tablets of law from Moses and God, and this Ark would be on the water, and it would also hold something, but it'd be a little different. The man pulls the Ark into the boat, and immediately it opens on its own. A book and a letter are found inside, and the book contains the Old and the New Testaments, including the works that would not have even been written about yet. The letter is from an apostle of Christ, called Bartholomew. His letter states that an angel appeared to him in a dream and advised him to commit this ark to the floods of the sea. And Bartholomew says, the same day they received this ark, salvation, peace, and goodwill from God and Jesus.
will be upon them. A gift of tongues was bestowed upon both of these works, so anybody that's reading the Bible or the letter could understand it. So as it was written, they were saved by an ark that was sent by God and St. Bartholomew. The second question they asked the governor was, how did Ben Salem have all this knowledge and customs and other languages from all the different parts of the world? And also, how was it that they kept this island so secretive and that no one in Europe had ever heard about it? I mean, the knowledge, the education, the book, surely we Europeans, as learned and educated as we are, would know about you. But we don't, so how? The governor graciously explained some history of the great shipping powers of the past. The governor then brings up Salamona, who was a great and wise leader that lived 1900 years prior to when this book was written in the 1500s. So it kind of aligns up with, you know, around the time of Plato. This leader, Salamona, realizes that they need to be self-sufficient, have an immigration policy, and assimilate those that choose to stay in Ben Salem. Because the treatment and conditions were so good there compared to the rest of the world, nobody really wanted to leave. The governor said no ship had ever decided to return to their own country, and only 13 people throughout all these years ever went back. And this was the main reason why Ben Salem had been kept so secret. It was like a magnet to talent, explorers, and people who yearned for a better life. Once they landed, they weren't likely to leave and spread the word of this place. They were happy where they were. Moving into probably what is the most important concept that Bacon's trying to explain in this book comes next. The governor explains that one of the greatest things this leader, King Salamona, did was to erect and create a society of order of Solomon's house. And the Solomon name being derived from the Hebrew king, King Solomon, the wise, wealthy ruler of the Israelites. Now, this place was like a modern day research institution, for the true nature of all things whereby God would have the glory. King Salamona would also declare a law forbidding all navigation of his peoples into foreign waters. But every 12 years, they would send two ships with members of this society of Solomon's house to basically bring back the best knowledge, inventions, books, instruments, and ideas from around the world. A great quote in this section is this, and I love it. He says, "But thus you see, we maintain a trade not for gold, silver, or jewels, nor for silks, nor for spices, or any other commodity of matter, but only for God's first creature, which was light. To have light, I say, of the growth of all parts of the world." So the value in Ben Salem is not comprised of riches of the world, but of riches of the mind. The question is then presented to the crew. Do you plan to stay, or do you plan to return to where you came from? Upon deliberating this proposal, because this is something you don't take lightly, some of the members of the ship are invited to a Feast of the Families, which I thought was a pretty cool concept. It was just a big festival held when a man stayed alive long enough to see 30 of his persons derived from his body, all alive at the same time, above the age of 3. This feast was at the cost of the state, and it goes into a lot of the details, what I like to call the fixings and the toppings of this event. At this point, it's clear that this civilization's value on the family and the family unit is highly, highly regarded. Another great quote in this section is this one, "For the king is debtor to no man, but the propagation of his subjects." I love that. After the party is over, Joabin enters the scene, and the question is asked about the rules of marriage and taking multiple wives and the such. The answer there is that the people of Ben Salem are a very chaste and pious people, and that polygamy, although maybe not against the law, is frowned upon. He goes on to say, "For there is nothing amongst mortal men more far and admirable than the chaste minds of this people." He talks about the dissolute houses of Europe and how they have put marriage out of office. He compares it to a bargain, an alliance, a mutual agreement to get to a new status in life. Another great line from Joabin was this, "That whosoever is unchaste cannot reverence himself, and they say that the reverence of a man's self is, next religion, the chiefest bridles of all vices." Again, Bacon is putting into words what is hard for most of us to communicate. The last scene, so to speak, takes place, and the father of Solomon's house actually comes and speaks to the men to hear their final answer. But first, he goes into a little detail on how the country is set up. The four main points of the empire are these: the ends of our foundations, the preparations and instruments we have for our works, several employments and functions whereto our fellows are assigned, and the ordinance and rites which we observe. He goes on to discuss many topics such as altered waters, caves where experiments are performed, soil mitigations, grafting of plants, metallurgy, experiments, poisons, and all kinds of things. He goes into almost an obnoxious amount of detail here in the book. He tells you about the light they use, the heat, the mechanical machines, the observations of space, and all kinds of variations of sound making and frequency and amplification, from underwater machines to flying things. He literally covers it all. Bacon kind of lets his pen flow with these imaginative inventions and stuff like that. That would be amazing for the 1500s. And it's kind of insane to think that just 500 years later, we basically have everything he wrote about. So the New Atlantis kind of became a reality. I would say just not in the moral religious type aspect, which he kind of included. They then move into the employment and offices of people. And it sounds kind of familiar with The Giver, if you're familiar with that book. The jobs and employments are very specific to advancement and progression of the society and the improvement of the civilization. It's clear that the people of Ben Salem appreciate all the inventors of the world, even outside their civilization. They show that appreciation by erecting statues in their honor. And sadly, that's where the book ends. So as you can see, we're kind of still in that introductory stage, in my opinion, but it's still a good book, and it's still one that can leave you thinking nonetheless. So some takeaways. This book is a utopia type book. But not in the sense of like magic and dragons and wizards and stuff like that. I think Bacon really believed it was possible to create a place like this. And honestly, in some areas of the world, I think we've gotten pretty close. But many of us dream of a level of society that I don't think the world will be capable of allowing us to achieve. Plato's Republic being the first utopia book that I can kind of think of. And even then, it was kind of more an example to show his ideas versus an actual place. But to get to this level of achievement that Bacon's describing, he implies that morality and religion would be very important. But we have to consider that Ben Salem was also very diverse in that it allowed so many cultures in. It was kind of like that first melting pot when you think of America. As he mentions, different people from different lands kind of assimilating there. The commitment to the Christian faith and the virtues surrounding that faith is what appears to be the goal of Bacon's New Atlantis. The pillar of light and the small cedar chest, it almost sounds like a story from the Bible during that portion. And while reading, I had this kind of crazy idea in regards to a new story of the Bible. We know from reading the Old Testament that the Israelites turned away from God many times. God would come with signs and warnings and help constantly in the Old Testament, and the Israelites would constantly disobey and go their own ways into sin and human nature. Bacon seems to rewrite this story in a way that the people of Ben Salem actually take the message of God and, instead of disobeying, devoting themselves and that whole civilization entirely to God. So the New Atlantis kind of shows the reward God gives to not just an individual, but to the entire civilization as a whole for believing in him and having that faith in him. This Christian utopia, the New Atlantis, is almost like what could have happened if the Israelites would have just obeyed God's commands. Because for the civilizations like Ben Salem, wisdom is the gold and knowledge is the diamond mine. And just like King Solomon of the Israelites did not ask for riches or anything like that, he asked God for wisdom. And that is a very important part of this civilization as well. Most civilizations that rise to power struggle with this corruption of commodities and resources. The question is, how do you, not by regulating everything, but inspiring the people, so to speak, to value something greater than monetary resources? I do not think men with free will and ambition could honestly create a place like this that would be lasting. I think it could be created, but I don't know how long it could last. And Ben Salem holds some virtues to be so sacred, such as the family unit and the actual welfare of its citizenry, and even those that are not part of its citizenry, you know, immigrants and stuff like that. And I think we as a culture have deviated a little too far away from the family unit. But I think there will be a resurgence in that family unit direction as people continue to seek purpose and find a path in life. With that being said, I truly hope you enjoy my take on the New Atlantis, written by Francis Bacon. Next week, we discuss John Milton's This Word Gets Me. I've had to say it like 40 times before this video to actually try to even remotely get it right. Next week, we discuss John Milton's Areopagitica. Did I get that right? Areopagitica? I think I did. We're gonna roll with that one, which will be based on freedom of speech and the right to print without a license. So old, but yet so relevant. These episodes are all on podcast form, so if you'd rather listen to them on any of the podcasting platforms, please do so. I will link that site down in the description below. And as a coffee roaster, I roast the devil out of some amazing coffee. So if you want to partake in drinking some amazing specialty coffee, then check out the link to my website, which will be in the description below. You can use the code THECAUSE for 15% off your first order. And again, this channel has been such an amazing little journey so far. I am thoroughly enjoying going through all these books. I love it. It's just, if I could ever make this my job, life would be set. Good coffee, great books. What more could you ask for in life? With that being said, I may slow down a little bit over the holidays, but rest assured, come January, I got some pretty big plans for 2024, so the videos will continue to start rolling in January. So enjoy your holidays, have a Merry Christmas, and I will see you soon. Read some amazing books, drink some amazing coffee. I love you all. And as always, stay blessed.
I was making lots of noise, busking on the city streets. I came back from Brooklyn, but you didn't come back for me.